is chapter 4, part 1 of Pauline Tabor's autobiography. This chapter is called Girls, Girls, Girls. If there's such a thing as a public image of a madame, I'm certain it must be a wholly unpleasant caricature of a tough, grasping, cold-hearted woman with about as much human warmth and sentimentality as a statistics incubating computer at the Census Bureau. I'll plead guilty. Of partially conforming to such an image. By the time I returned to Bowling Green after my ill-fated adventures in Indiana and Louisville, I learned that as a madame, you have to be tough to survive. I didn't smoke and I rarely took a drink, but I could and did cuss like a dock worker when the occasion arose. I had had my baptism as a jailbird. I was thoroughly indoctrinated in the hard-boiled ins and outs of brothel keeping, and with my girth expanded to the 240-pound proportions of a professional football tackle, I was also quite capable of taking over the job of bouncer when a customer became obnoxiously unruly. To compound such felonies against society's code of ladylike behavior, I was mercenary. I was a sex merchant for the same basic reason that motivates other people to peddle pills, groceries, clothing, toys, cars, and all manner of other wares, to make money and acquire the better things of life. I believe this materialistic instinct is deeply ingrained in most women. In fact, I've often suspected that a lot of married females' animosity towards prostitution is generated by jealousy. She simply can't stand the thought that some women are profiting on a commodity she gives away. In any event, I was as commercial as the devil himself when it came to sex. From my cynical viewpoint, rooted in a constantly growing disillusionment with mankind's furtive sexual attitudes, love was just a four-letter word, and it definitely wasn't spelled with an L. Yes, I'll cop a plea on all of these alleged shortcomings, but there's one thing with all my faults that I wasn't. I wasn't cold-hearted, and I wasn't devoid of warmth and sentimentality. Try as I might to keep these human qualities in check when the practical objective of making a buck was concerned, I was never completely successful in having my head rule over my heart. After a long lifetime as a madame, I'm convinced that compassion and sentimentality are frequently found in overabundance in a whorehouse. The reason for this strange mixture of hard-headed commercialism and soft-hearted emotionalism is simple. Beyond the money-making process, there's no glamour in the merchandising of sex. A madame and her girls are cut off from the normal society in which they once moved, exiles in a lonely little world bounded by the walls of their house. As a result, they tend to adopt each other as family. Although they indulge in gossip, petty jealousies, and quarrels, they develop a sense of loyalty and concern for one another's problems, a tolerant acceptance of human faults which sometimes even extends to the customers they serve. Today, in my retirement, I'm linked with the past by a host of sentimental memories of my girls. Some of these memories are sad. Others, like classic fairy tales, have happily ever after endings, and many still sparkle with bawdy humor. I recall, for example, one frantic night in my colonial country house when Rosie, an apprentice in the business, really earned her status as a professional lady of the evening. It was during the early days of World War II. Across the land, military installations were jammed with young men in uniform, newly converted civilians, far from home, and loved ones with a singular devotion to the pursuit of carnal companionship before they went marching off to war. Kentucky's Camp Campbell was one of these wartime posts, and it provided me with a never-slackening flow of GIs eager to sample the pleasures of my house. At times, particularly right after the Army's payday, this military traffic, when added to my usually busy civilian trade, was almost more than my stable of six girls could handle. On one of these hectic weekend nights after payday, when the tricks had passed steadily through the house, hour after hour, like an endless, impatient chow line, I found myself without enough girls to go around. It was after 2 a.m, and all but one of my girls had bedded down with all-night customers when three soldiers arrived. With their amorous ambitions magnified by an evening of beer guzzling and their bankroll still in a healthy state, they were horny and raring to go and determined to enjoy the luxury of $25 all-night dates. "Well, fellas," I said, "it's awfully late. Most of my girls are tied up for the rest of the night, but I'll see what I can do." Slowly, I climbed the stairs to assess the situation. I hated the thought of turning away a three-man $75 deal. Hopefully, I thought that perhaps the energies of a couple of the earlier all-nighters would have faded, and I'd find two or three of my girls relaxing in a small private upstairs sitting room where they sometimes retreated for a cigarette when their overnight chicks were sleeping after an especially arduous session of lovemaking. Unfortunately, this night's tricks were of a hardier breed. Rosie was the only girl in the room, the only one of my stable who didn't have an all-nighter. Rosie was a newcomer to the business. She'd come to my house in search of a job about a month earlier, an attractive 21-year-old brunette from a small town south of Bowling Green. She told me after completing 2 years of college, she'd run out of money. However, she was determined to finish her education and get a teaching degree, and she decided that a temporary career as a prostitute was the most practical, quickest solution for her financial difficulties. When I protested that she had no experience in our tough trade, she overcame my objections by coolly pointing out, "I've been giving it away for pleasure since I was in high school, so I might as well get paid for it for a while." As is so the case with girls who become prostitutes with a definite worthwhile ambition in mind, Rosie was a quick and willing learner. Thus, when I hurried into the room that night, she instantly realized that an emergency had arisen. "What's the problem?" she asked. "Have we got a late customer panting in the parlor?" "One customer," I explained. "We got three beer-soaked GIs down there, and I don't want their ashes hauled. They want all-night parties." Rosie grinned impishly. "I'll take them on." "Honey, these boys aren't looking for a gangbang. Each wants a girl for his very own." "Leave it to me," Rosie said. "When I get through with them, they won't know the difference. Just tell them there's only one girl available right now, so two of them will have to wait until two more girls are free. Then turn the lights in the parlor down low, give them a couple more beers, and I'll handle the rest of the details." I couldn't see how Rosie planned to turn herself into three girls, but with a $75 stud fee involved, I was willing to try anything, so I followed her instructions. The soldiers accepted my explanation that two of them would have to wait until more girls were available. They flipped a coin, and a big, brawny sergeant won the first girl. Minutes later, Rosie entered the room wearing a pale yellow evening gown with her long, dark hair freshly brushed. The sergeant claimed his date and went lurching upstairs for his all-nighter. His buddies whistled in appreciation. "Hot damn," one of the soldiers said. "If the other two gals are as good as that one, we're in luck." "Believe me, fellows," I said as I fetched beers for the eager pair, "the other two girls will be exactly as good." The two remaining Romeos in khaki were working on their third bottles of beer when Rosie returned to the parlor about 40 minutes later. This time she was wearing a sexy lacy blue negligee, and her hair had been redone in an elegant upsweep style. The GIs ogled her hungrily and repeated the coin toss. The victor and his new girl hurried upstairs, leaving one soldier still at the starting gate. To keep him busy, I told him that no more upstairs bedrooms were available, and I asked him to help me prepare a convertible sofa in a first floor back parlor. By this time, we were finished with the bed-making preparations for his party, and I'd supplied him with another beer. Rosie was back downstairs. This time, she was dressed in a low-cut red gown, and her hair was braided and pinned smartly across the top of her head. "Baby, it was a long wait, but it was worth it," the third musketeer sighed as he tottered off to the back parlor with his date for the night. Fearing complications in Rosie's game of musical beds, I didn't get any sleep that night. However, there wasn't a single outcry by an indignant soldier. I was still in the parlor at 9 o'clock that morning when the GI trio began to assemble for their departure. They showed up in the parlor in about 20-minute intervals at the same order in which they had claimed their dates the previous night. "What a woman I had," the sergeant chortled to his companions. "Four times I had it. Four fucking times." "Me too," each of his buddies exclaimed, marveling at the coincidental proof of their virility. And they left the house arguing about who had the best girl for the night. As soon as I saw the soldiers out the door, I rushed to the upstairs sitting room. Rosie was sprawled in the lounge chair, warily puffing on a cigarette. "My God, Rosie, I still don't believe it," I said. "Those soldiers left as happy as jaybirds, and each one was sure he had his own date for the night. How in the hell did you do it?" "In the first place," Rosie exclaimed, she was sure that after a night of bar hopping, the three GI tricks wouldn't have too much endurance. She took the sergeant off to bed, gave him a brisk workout, and he dozed off to sleep. She slipped out of bed, put on a negligee, fixed her hair in a different style, and went down to claim her second date. She repeated the performance, and after number two quickly fell asleep following his manly exertions, she donned still another costume, changed her hairdo again, and showed up for the third date, who followed the same bang-bang Betty style as his buddies. That was the start of a busy night for Rosie. With number three safely asleep, she hurried back upstairs to the bed of number one. She awakened him and said she was lonely. Being a gentleman, he rose to the challenge, took care of her loneliness, and promptly dozed off again. She repeated the performance with number two and number three with the same results, then began her rounds through the house once more. On the third time around, the soldiers responded groggily but valiantly to Rosie's call to arms, although number two fell asleep in the midst of the action. She tenderly tucked him in bed and proceeded on the now rumpled couch of number three, who apparently having regained his wind, frolicked through a long party before resuming his interrupted napping. It was well past daylight that Sunday morning when Rosie started her last and most critical tour of duty. To convince each of her tricks that he truly had an all-night date, it was vital that she be in his bed when he awoke. To accomplish this, she had to rely on the probability that the combination of many beers and three lusty sex sessions in a few hours would finally put her dates into a deep sleep. She hurried to the bed of soldier number one. He was snoring contentedly, but she shook him awake. "Darling," she whispered sexily, caressing him gently, "it's getting late and I have to get ready for church, but you've been so sweet, you deserve one more for the road before you leave." Rosie made sure the last one was a quickie. Then, while the first soldier was showering and getting dressed, she scurried to the bedroom at number two, woke him up, repeated the performance, and scampered on downstairs to her last encore with number three. An amazing performance. It was magnificent. So magnificent, in fact, that she got a generous tip from each of her all-night dates in addition to the $25 per man fee. Obviously, great things can be expected of a girl with that kind of determination and talent, and Rosie didn't disappoint my high expectations. Although she never again equaled that night's triple threat endurance record, she worked in my colonial house for more than a year. At last, with a hefty bank account, she retired, returned to college, and graduated with honors, a graduation which I attended at her invitation. After getting her diploma, she went to work as a teacher in a southern city. In a few years, she married and raised a family of four children. Her husband never suspected her one-time career, but, like the three tricks she handled so deftly that frantic night, I'm certain he fully enjoyed her remarkable, satisfying talents. Rosie, however, was just one of a number of my girls, and I guess that several hundred worked for me at one time or another over the years, who used prostitution as a stepping stone to a better, more prosperous life in a society from which they'd once retreated. Like Rosie, these smart girls retired as soon as they had accumulated enough money to realize their hopes for the future. Generally, these ambitions were centered on plans to acquire a profitable, respectable business of their own, a dress shop, a beauty salon, a restaurant, or varied other enterprises. Quite often, these plans for a return to respectability also included dreams of romance, marriage, and children. Faye was one of my smart girls, a truly unique human being. She came unannounced to my house on Clay Street one day, asking if I had an opening for a girl. I could scarcely believe my eyes. My house was famous for its good-looking girls, but a woman like this just wasn't the type you'd expect to find in a small Kentucky town. Everything about Faye, her poise and bearing, her vocabulary, her chic, expensive clothing, was eloquent testimony to a well-bred cosmopolitan upbringing. Faye, indeed, was a lovely young woman, and she possessed a rare exotic quality beyond her beauty of face and form. Tall and willowy, with raven hair that cascaded below her shoulders, dark snapping eyes, and a flawless olive complexion, Faye had an old-world sort of charm and an elusive air of mystery that could drive men out of their minds. She was, in brief, a man-devastating package of pure sex. Seated in my parlor, I quickly sized up Faye's bountiful physical endowments, as well as her obviously costly custom-made beige suit and her handsome leather handbag. This certainly was no girl from the backcountry. "I don't mean to be nosy, honey," I said, "but you don't look like a girl who'd want to work in a house in Bowling Green, Kentucky. You look more Park Avenue to me." Faye smiled enigmatically, as if she were enjoying a personal kind of joke on herself. "You're close," she replied in a soft, cultured voice. "I'm from New York, but I became bored with the big city life and decided it was time for a change." "But how'd you learn about me? I'm sure my house isn't exactly a household word in the big city." Faye explained that she'd been driving across the country looking for a town that suited her fancy. Bowling Green appealed to me, so I stopped at a hotel and asked the bellboy if there was a high-class house in the area. He recommended that I talk with you. During our conversation, Faye had been glancing appreciatively around the parlor and a portion of my large living room, visible through an archway connecting the two rooms. I could see she was quietly evaluating the quality of the decor, including the authentic antiques I had extravagantly collected over a period of years.
Judging by what I see, Faye added, the bellboy knew what he was talking about. This is certainly no ordinary house. It's beautiful. Faye couldn't have chosen a better compliment to win my heart. I was inordinately proud of the job I'd done in transforming the big brick house from a state of shabby disrepair into a luxurious establishment. As far as an exterior elegance and setting were concerned, my house on Clay Street couldn't compare with the beauty and charm of my colonial country place before it was destroyed by fire. The Clay Street house was surrounded by a large yard which I had lovingly landscaped, but even the well-kept lawn, shrubbery, and flower gardens couldn't disguise the fact that the house was situated across from the railroad tracks near the town's stockyards. It was an ideal location for privacy, but it was certainly far from a perfect environment for a dream house. However, after the loss of my colonial house, I decided that the operator of a bordello can't expect to have everything. My country place had an abundance of charming atmosphere, but its remoteness was an inconvenience for customers. The alternative was to buy a place in town. To get the in-city privacy my business required, I had to locate a non-residential area safely removed from the prying eyes and easily aroused indignation of respectable neighbors. Thus, to make up for its seedy locale, I'd spared no expense in converting the interior of the house on Clay Street into another world. Here, I catered lavishly to my expensive tastes in interior decorating and antiques, filling the house with beauty. Once inside the door, my house was indeed a posh place for gentlemen who had a cultivated appetite for gracious loving, an establishment truly worthy of a regal courtesan like Faye. Despite the satisfaction of having my house praised by a discerning woman, I found it impossible to believe Faye's story that day. Sophisticated, well-educated young ladies like her don't just wander impulsively along the nation's highways and byways looking for a job as a prostitute. But I wasn't about to question the veracity of her explanation, for she was the kind of girl a madame dreams about but rarely finds. Although she provided me with no information about her past experience, it was obvious from her knowledge of a house operations and fees, which she frankly discussed on a sharp business-like basis, that Faye was no amateur. I welcomed her to my stable with open arms. I never had cause to regret my action. Faye became an overnight sensation and continued to be the star attraction of my house during the 3 years she worked for me. As I had realized at our first meeting, she was a highly skilled professional. She could get more money out of a man than any girl I'd ever met, and still satisfy the customer so thoroughly that he'd come back for more time after time. I'd seen many a trick after a date with Faye hurriedly leave the house to replenish his bankroll and return an hour or so later for another party with her. There was only one thing that bothered me. Faye was a loner. Her past, her problems, her ambitions, and her true identity remained a mystery. With the customers, she was an outgoing, vivacious person full of laughter and human warmth, but in her free time she withdrew into her own private world, rarely mixing with the other girls during off-duty hours. Fearing that her withdrawals might be an indication that Faye, behind her shell of seemingly calm reserve, was waging a lonely inner battle with some desperate problem, I asked her one day if something was troubling with her. She appeared to be surprised by the question. "Of course not," she replied. "What gave you that idea?" "Well," I said, "the other girls are puzzled because you keep to yourself so much. They think that you're either stuck up and feel you're too good for them or terribly unhappy about something. They just can't figure you out." Faye expressed an immediate concern, saying that she hadn't realized she was creating a morale problem among the girls. "I certainly don't feel like I'm better than the others," she said. "It's just that after a long night's work trying to please all sorts of men, I enjoy relaxing in my room, reading books and magazines, writing letters, working on embroidery, and just plain daydreaming. I didn't realize it might look snobbish. From now on, though, I'll try to spend more time with the other girls." Faye kept her word. From then on, she did more socializing with the girls. She didn't have much to say, but she'd laugh at their jokes, listen to their gossip, and occasionally join in their lusty recollection of the more fascinating hang-ups of their customers. However, she never discussed her past, a generally popular pastime among prostitutes. Faye worked tirelessly for more than 4 months without a break, even though I frequently urged her to follow the schedule I recommended for all my girls. 3 weeks on the job, followed by a week or two of relaxation away from the house. Then one day she asked for time off. "I have to go home on business," she said without adding any details. "I'm not sure how long I'll be gone. Perhaps 3 or 4 weeks." I regretfully said goodbye to Faye, telling her to have a fine vacation. In my heart, though, I was convinced that she'd tired of Bowling Green and would never return. She left most of her clothing and other personal possessions in her room, but I figured she planned to send for these later, after she was safely removed from any painful parting of the way scenes. I was wrong, however. About a month later, Faye returned to the house on Clay Street as casually as if she'd been on a brief errand at the corner grocery. She revealed nothing of where she'd been or what she'd done. She merely returned to the job of delighting her customers. After that month's absence, Faye continued to work for me for more than 2 years, interrupting her labors of love periodically for her mysterious business trips. It wasn't until she announced abruptly one day that she was retiring from the business that Faye finally lifted the curtain of secrecy with which she had shrouded her past life. As might be expected, it was an extraordinary story from an extraordinary woman, and I listened spellbound as she told it to me. Faye had, as a child and a young girl, enjoyed the luxury of being one of two children of a wealthy Connecticut couple. During the Depression, however, her father's business had failed. By that time, she graduated from college, and the last traces of her family fortune had faded, and her distressed father had killed himself rather than live out his years in unaccustomed poverty. Faye's younger brother at that time had just started the long and costly study for priesthood, and she was determined to help him financially. "I settled in New York and got a job as a model," she said. "In that job, I made a lot of important contacts. Before long, I was offered a profitable sideline as a high-priced call girl. I accepted the offer with no qualms because making money had become my biggest goal in life." Between modeling and servicing well-to-do gentlemen, Faye's annual income flourished in the comfortable five-figure brackets. She was able to pay her brother's education costs, help support her widowed mother, who was living with a sister in New England, and still accumulate a sizable savings account. By the time her brother was ordained as a priest, she'd invested a large portion of her savings into a down payment on a long-established summer and winter vacation resort in Vermont. "Then the roof fell in," Faye said. "After my brother was ordained, he was signed to a parish in New York City. I realized immediately that I would have to leave New York. If I were ever caught in a vice raid or involved in a scandal, it would ruin my brother's life. There's just not enough room, even in New York, for a brother who's a priest and a sister who's a prostitute." Faye, however, decided she would continue in the profession in some distant, off-the-beaten-track town until she'd earned enough to pay off the balance due on her resort investment. That's how she ended up working in my house in Bowling Green, and her periodic business trips were devoted to overseeing the operations of her resort and visiting her mother and brother, both of whom thought she was employed as the manager of a women's apparel shop in Kentucky. "When I left New York, I vowed that I'd quit the business I mailed the last payment on my resort," Faye said. "Today, I put that last check in the mail. Now I'm going back to run my resort full-time." A week or so later, I received a telephone call from the post office informing me they had just received a large, heavily insured package protected by a sturdy wooden crate. "The cumbersome package was addressed to me," the postal clerk said, "and would I please come down and take the blasted thing off their hands?"